This is Conducting Business, WQXR's podcast on the business of the classical music world. I'm Jeff Spurgeon. A new concert season spells renewal and regeneration, but you don't have to look too hard to find examples of orchestras and opera companies and presenters struggling in the face of a weak economy. It raises an issue we're looking at today. How much money should the head of a major performing arts organization be paid? And should executives be paid less for failing to keep finances in good standing, or more, because managing such a crisis is so difficult? We'll get two views on this. Joining me first is Drew McManus, an orchestra consultant and author of the blog Adaptistration.com. For the past several years, he's published an annual compensation report that looks at the salaries of top managers and conductors and musicians. Drew, how has the drop in funding streams for arts organizations since the financial crisis of 2008 affected executive compensation in those organizations?
Well, that's probably a good thing to set up for listeners. First is how compensation figures are reported publicly in what's known as the IRS 990 form. Those, unfortunately, come out about a year and a half after an actual season. So they're always going to be about 18 to anywhere up to 24 months behind the current time. The most recent figures for all organizations only cover the 08-09 season, which was the first year of the economic downturn. And in that time, although each stakeholder group had a drop in the increase they had experienced in previous years, they all still experienced increases.
So it then would seem that, in fact, the salaries do go up because it is hard to manage in a crisis. Is that fair to say?
Well, to a degree, yes. I mean, there are groups who are certainly doing very well right now with managing debt, which is one of the primary challenges in any nonprofit organization in an economic downturn. And there are groups who are actually expanding during this period as well.
Can you give us just one example?
Sure. Like a group who's doing an excellent job at not really just managing debt, but also increasing a bit from season to season is in Nashville, Tennessee, the Nashville Symphony Orchestra, who they really have, I think, one of the best executives in the business today, Alan Valentine. They've weathered not just the economic crisis, but they had an issue where they were out of their brand new concert hall for nearly 6 months due to the flooding that happened in Nashville a while back. And during that period of time, they not only were able to keep all of their employees, including cooks, who they weren't able to use but reassigned to other duties, because they realized in the long term, keeping those people around and finding ways to manage the debt at that point in time was worth keeping those employees in the organization from a long-term point of view. And because of that, I think their executive is worth whatever they ostensibly want to pay him.
There have been some well-publicized difficulties, though. The Philadelphia Orchestra declared bankruptcy. The orchestras in Honolulu and Syracuse and Louisville did. And a lot of them have been dealing with tough bargaining over musicians, over compensation and benefits, Detroit Symphony being one of the examples there. Is there a quid pro quo, then, in an organization that has trouble? If the rank and file are asked to take reductions, do the executives do it as well?
Yes, that's not unusual, and it's not unusual for executives to sometimes come out and take a cut or even cut all the staff salaries before they approach negotiations. And there are pros and cons in a bargaining standpoint for either of those directions. I do think you mentioned, though, Detroit is a good example, because that's one situation where executive compensation was really an issue. Because one thing that has changed recently in the last few years is how compensation is being reported for executives. And a lot of the very large number perks that never used to exist maybe 10 to 15 years ago that are commonplace today that don't work their way into the publicly disclosed figures.
Ah, okay. Well, those may be a little bit harder to uncover. Can you give us any examples?
Well, the Philadelphia example you had mentioned was decent. In their bankruptcy proceeding, they actually had to list some of that content, and there were some very heavy moving expenses. I think it was in the neighborhood of $75,000 to $76,000. There's also back-end compensation where agreements will be made that when an executive leaves, they're guaranteed X number of years of consulting fees.
All right. Thank you, Drew McManus. I want to bring in the other member of our conversation today. Deborah Oppenheim is co-founder of Phillips Oppenheim, an executive search firm that specializes in arts institutions. She's based here in New York. Deborah's search committees
have a challenge. They're looking for leaders with a balance of money-making backgrounds and artistic backgrounds. How has that balance shifted since the economy declined in 2008?
I can't tell you that the balance has shifted, because as searches are being done for leading talent, for leading visionary managers, directors, and so on, an organization, even in these difficult times, knows it needs to pay a competitive salary to attract the right kind of person or to keep a successful executive in place. And so there's always that pull and tug between the competition and the level of experience and management needed to attract a leader who will meet expectations.
I'm a little surprised to hear that. I would think that organizations would be really keying in on people who can do the money part of the business and looking maybe to somebody else, some other staff member, to focus on the artistic side.
That may well be the case, but you can't swap that for the visionary leadership needed in marketing, in fundraising, in external relations, in board management, in day-to-day operations, in the artistic piece as related to an orchestra, for example, that has a music director. But the expectation is that the executive director or chief executive officer certainly has an artistic knowledge and underpinning to speak knowledgeably to many publics. So you can't just go and pluck out a financial person from the corporate sector who may love symphony orchestras or classical music and say, aha, now we've got our answer. Because that begs the question in terms of the scope and range of the people that are being sought after.
Who then ultimately decides what an arts leader is worth? Is it the board? Is it based on income, the public? Who finally decides what this executive is worth?
For lack of another term, it usually is the board, the compensation committee of the board. And regardless of the pressures from outside, and they may be from statistics, they may be from newspaper articles and journalists, they may be from bloggers, they may be from consultants and so on and so forth. In terms of doing a search and getting down to the very last pieces of that search, the search committee or the board or whoever will do whatever they need to do to attract the best possible talent. And that may bend a lot of noses out of joint. One would hope we lived in an altruistic world where leaders would be flexible in terms of salary, where some standards or measures could be used to measure success. But the reality is, when you get down to the last crunches of a search, the board, whoever, will do whatever they need to do within reason, to attract the best possible talent.
Let's take the top three moneymakers in this world, according to Drew McManus's list that he compiled. Deborah Borda, Los Angeles Philharmonic. She runs the orchestra there. Her compensation, as of these figures are all of late 2009, $1.4 million. Zarin Mehta, who runs the Philharmonic in New York, just over $1 million. And Mark Volpe at the Boston Symphony, a little more than $600,000 a year. Now, how have their incomes, Drew, changed in keeping with those of others in their organizations? Are they getting bigger bumps than the people who work under them?
In those three organizations, actually, those are probably good examples to pick, because the executives there, with the exception of a couple of big one-year spikes in New York and Los Angeles, are pretty much on par with everyone else. That's not the way it is through the entire field when you figure in the averages. But those are three good examples of executives that don't have substantial changes over their other peer stakeholders.
Now, Alison Vulgamore is getting a little, well, very close to $600,000 a year to lead the Philadelphia Orchestra, one of the organizations that has, and is really still in the midst of a difficult financial circumstance. Her salary is sort of at the middle of a scale that includes the top 10 U.S. orchestras. But how does that compare to the highest paid musicians and administrators in her organization? Is there any difference in that organization, which is troubled, frankly?
Well, if you look at her compensation, because she's relatively new in her tenure compared to her predecessors, her two previous CEOs, she had by far the largest jump in compensation. And that far exceeded the jump in compensation over the same time period for musicians, their concertmaster, or their music directors.
Is that a bad thing?
Well, I think Deborah really touched on the point that is at issue here. It's not so much whether or not an initial CEO coming in and the board determining what the value of that person is to attract the person they want with all the competitive issues in place. It's going to be the subsequent evaluation. Because the one thing I talk about a lot in these compensation reviews is the difference between rewarding effort over achievement. Everybody's working hard. Even people who don't do necessarily a great job at what they do typically still work very hard. And that's the problem in most of these organizations, is the assessment process after an executive has been brought in.
I mean, I managed the search for Alison Vogelmaer. And just from a search person's perspective, before the bankruptcy was declared and so on, we scoured the field. Philadelphia did need to find the most dynamic and experienced leader that they could find who was willing to move to Philadelphia and take on all of the issues that were predominant at that time. There was no chair, there was no leader, there was no music director, and so on. Obviously, with the financial issues that have occurred ongoing and the crisis in general, people look at compensation or at the Philadelphia's compensation, Allison's compensation, and may raise questions, but she's still in that leadership role to try to pull this organization managerially out of its crisis and problems.
Cultural executives still generally earn less than their counterparts in the private sector. So, and some people have made the jump from private to not-for-profit. Probably the most high-profile example is Peter Gelb at the Metropolitan Opera. He was running Sony Music for a lot of money and then came to the Metropolitan Opera for a lot of money, but a lot less money than he was making. How do arts groups lure people?
Passion, passion, passion. Peter Gelb was passionate about the opera. And again, I know that from our firsthand engagement in that process. And so this is something that Peter Gelb wanted to do from the time to run the Metropolitan Opera, from the time he probably was a young guy. And if I remember correctly, he worked there early on. His family was connected. So money isn't the driver in that case. When people are recruited from the corporate sector, they are often recruited at a time when they, and not all, but many have earned enough of a cushion when their families are moved enough along so that they don't have college tuitions to face and all the expenses that many of us do. But those individuals can afford to take a gamble.
It doesn't sound like much of a gamble to go from a $4 million salary to a $1.5 million salary. But I suppose that's how they look at it, and maybe that's the reality. Are the skill sets so much different for a corporate executive in the private world as opposed to a corporate executive in the not-for-profit world? Can you move from that saltwater pond to the freshwater pond without any problems?
If the mission and passion piece is in place, yes, you can. I think in terms of skill sets, I would urge affinity groups, whether it's the league, whether it's whatever, to look at possible young talent coming along or people who are in the corporate sector who are serving on boards who really have the inner desire to run some of these organizations, and ensure that a lot of these younger people coming along get the professional and academic underpinnings that they need, meaning, a good MBA, and that isn't the be-all and end-all, but who understands how to analyze in the future, what does an organization look like? What do we need? What resources do we need? Where is the money coming from? What kind of programming makes sense, and certainly artistic sense, that also allows us to balance our budgets. So it sometimes is difficult to find the people with the business underpinnings that also have the artistic sensibility and know how to manage some of these complex organizations.
Drew McManus, in doing your analysis of the salaries of these organizations, what can you tell us about perks that some of these executives might get that are outside the financial line?
Well, there's going to be the traditional golden parachute sort of things. All the compensation that's promised through the consulting fees after an executive leaves, everything from, of course, cars, housing allowances. You mentioned Detroit. That's one of, I think, the key issues there was the actual executive receives an entire house. And then moving expenses, health care.
And Drew, you break down annual compensation increases by different groups in 2009. And these are, I think, interesting numbers. Executives in that year, executives at not-for-profit arts organizations, saw an increase of almost 5.5% in their compensation.
Right.
Concert masters at orchestras saw a compensation of 3.7%. Musicians, 2.2%. Music directors at 1.5%. I was surprised by these figures. I was surprised that music directors got a smaller bump than concert masters. The people playing in the orchestra got a bigger salary increase than the guy or the woman up on the podium. What does this tell us?
I'm glad you actually mentioned that one. There's an interesting phenomenon inside this business because the organizations that I include in the compensation reports are going to be from the largest budget groups like New York and L.A. down through, we've got about 72 that are included now. So they'll be in budgets that are maybe going to max out around $2.5 million. So when you have a music director or two in some of the largest budget organizations who are maybe between music directors that year, so there's no music director compensation to report, that brings the average down tremendously.
Right.
So in that particular year, that actually, music director stakeholders actually suffered under what I call a real average, which is if you factor that out, it would be a bit higher than that. But to give you kind of a broader perspective of it, since the reports were in place about 8 years ago, here's the breakdown of increases over that period of time through the 08-09 season. Executives have had a 7.3% increase. Music directors have had a 4.3% increase. Concert masters have had 4.8. Bass musicians have had 2.2. And the total expenditures for those organizations have increased at about 4.3%.
Well, that maybe is a little more telling. Deborah, you're taking lots of notes as we have this conversation, and I don't want to miss the points that you may be wanting to offer. So,
what I would really stress is that there are so many variables as related to salaries even in these very critical times. It would be wonderful if people were as altruistic and invested they are, but altruistic to forego major increases so the parity issues aren't so disparate. But it doesn't work that way. And so hopefully getting back to the partnership between the artistic director and the chief executive, that partnership has to work for the organization to work.
There is an example of that happening at least in some level at Pittsburgh. The music director there took a pay cut along with the musicians. I don't know if the executives did or not. Do we know any other examples of that happening?
It is pretty common for them to take a cut alongside a cut of any other major stakeholder. The exact numbers are always up for debate and discussion. But I think something that Deborah said is really important to touch on, which is that altruistic nature of whether an executive wants to take a cut on the same parity with the other stakeholders. The primary one, I think, that is the source of conflict is going to be the musicians. Because the one thing I don't think we've talked about is an executive's skill set with labor relations.
And the rank and file is very close to the surface, is
correct.
What you're saying. Yeah.
And then if you look at the groups that are really doing the best now with managing debt and not having any kind of public crisis, are going to be groups that have had a history of a very strong positive labor relationship. Nashville was a great example. Deborah out in Los Angeles is another good example. She's had a good relationship with those musicians. So even though there are groups that may be suffering problems, if they have a good relationship in place, a lot of the other points that you see stakeholders fight over, with parity issues especially, don't seem to have as much impact because there's more mutual respect and trust in place to help buffer some of that out.
Deborah Oppenheim, you'd echo what Drew just said.
I think that was one of the reasons why Alison Vogelmoor was selected as the CEO of the Philadelphia Orchestra. There certainly are musicians on all of these search committees, and there were musicians on this search committee. And I think her relationship or potential relationship with the musicians was a big factor in her selection. And I often wondered, by the way, as a search person, how that actually has played out in the last 2 years. I would assume successfully enough that she's still in place.
Right, right. Well, there's one element, and I'm glad, Drew, that you brought up the labor element, but there's one group of people involved in large orchestras that we haven't dealt with at all and that doesn't get talked about very much, and that is the fees for soloists. Are those fees for soloists scrutinized in these evaluations at all? What we understand is the top soloists can get $60,000, $70,000 a night, some maybe even a little more to do a program. And some people say that's something that really strains orchestral budgets. Drew?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's interesting because that component, soloists and artist management firms, are unique in that they are a for-profit entity that works almost exclusively in a nonprofit field. So you don't find information about soloists reported outside of a few exceptions. Like some of the largest budget organizations may hire a soloist that it happens to be someone who represents themselves ostensibly. They're so big. So you'll actually see on the 990 that soloist listed for their fee for whatever one concert they came in and did that year. But by and large, those fees are usually reported cumulatively to the individual firms. You'll find a listing for Cameo or Opus 3 in the 990, and it will show the total amount paid to them, but it won't drill down into how much any individual soloist is paid.
Cameo and Opus 3 are artist organizations that manage lots of classical artists. So are they getting paid too much? Are the soloists getting paid too much? And do board, maybe you know the answer to this, Deborah, do boards ever talk about that?
In a word, no.
Because I didn't think it was going to be a hard question, but I posed it anyway.
No. Because obviously when we're doing the search, for the most part, we're concentrating on the broader visionary management type of leader as opposed to the artist.
Drew, what do you hear under the radar about that?
I think Deborah's right on the nose with that. There is something that has changed a bit over the years with the highest priced soloist, where they would be engaged by some of the middle budget and lower budget groups. I think we've been focusing a lot on the highest budget, but in the long tail theory, that those organizations actually perform for the smallest percentage of people who consume live classical music, if you want to think of it in that sort of sense. But it used to be that you would hire a large name soloist for your gala, and that alone would still be enough to clear a really good profit with normal fundraising. But now it's looked at a little bit more as an investment with a much smaller profit margin for the gala and more of a status symbol than it used to be maybe 10 or 15 years ago.
So where are we headed? If the economy does not improve substantially in a fairly short time, will salaries come under more scrutiny, or are arts leaders somewhat insulated from the difficulties of a tough economy?
Again, even with a tough economy, I think that within reason, when someone is being recruited or when someone's salary, and a successful leader, you can use Deborah Borda as an example, the Los Angeles Philharmonic will do whatever they can do to keep her happy, because she certainly has produced.
So it's really it's what the market will bear, with the understanding that all of these special circumstances that affect and control and make up arts organizations are in place. But if we understand that we're in the arts world, it's the free market.
It's the free market. It's the product.
Drew, would you echo what Deborah is saying, or would you offer some different ideas?
Well, I think she's right on the mark. I might expand on that a bit, though, from the perspective that one thing that would certainly benefit the business from that labor relations standpoint, which I still think ultimately in the long term is going to determine the overall health of the business of orchestras, is a substantial increase in the amount of transparency that exists with executive compensation and, to a much larger degree, subsequent annual review of performance. That's conducted in not just a more transparent arena, but there are some real firm, quantifiable justifications behind why an executive is kept on board.
Also, that increased transparency would make it easier to write your blog, too, wouldn't it, Drew?
Would have to do a lot less work. Yeah, I would agree with that.
We thank you both today. Drew McManus is a Chicago-based orchestra consultant, and his blog is adaptistration.com. And Deborah Oppenheim is co-founder of Phillips Oppenheim, a search firm for arts organizations and not-for-profits of all kinds. We thank you both so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
This is Conducting Business, WQXR's podcast on the business of the classical music world. I'm Jeff Spurgeon, and thank you for listening.